And she said, I know it's my turn tonight, and I'll have dinner ready soon, but let's cook together instead. And when the weather's better, let's mow the lawn and put on some tunes outside, and maybe paint the place up nice. 3 coats, just so we can do it together more than once. And we can do whatever we want with the place. A little space is a lot, and I want to read with you a book I just bought. Something good from start to finish, something new. And I want to do it all together with you, okay? And sometimes these things take a little longer than we thought, and please read slow, love. My ears are old, and my eyes are shot, and I hope it's not too late before we're done, and I know I'm quiet, but I'm having fun. And what am I talking about anyway? It's Saturday today, and we don't have anywhere to be tomorrow.
Jackson Armstrong, in his short story, Lindsay Then, read by Ann Colwell. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The 10th edition of the Delmarva Review was published in early November, and I'm pleased to have in the studio today Wilson Wyatt, the chairman of the review, and Ann Colwell, the review's poetry editor. Welcome, both of you, to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, Hal.
In the spirit of full disclosure, let me say also that I'm the co-fiction editor of the review, along with Melissa Reddish. Okay, our program is in two parts today. In the first part, we'll talk about the review with our guests. And in the second segment, we'll present a dramatic adaptation of the short story, The Church, by Philip Barbara. The Church was published in this 10th edition of the Delmarva Review. Wilson, let me begin with you. Please give us a little history of the Delmarva Review and tell us something about this current issue.
Thank you, Hal. It's it was started in 2008 by the Eastern Shore Writers Association. It was an opportunity to create a literary journal with roots here on the Eastern Shore and Delmarva Peninsula that was open to all writers to be a legitimate journal for literary writing. It gave a place, a home, if you will, to writers who were really proud of their best work to have an opportunity to publish it because nothing existed at that time. And it also took a number of years to establish ourselves as a legitimate literary journal that was recognized around the country as a place for welcome for all writers. Just so you understand, or so that the listeners can understand, if a person writes something that is exceptional, they want to look for the best place to publish it. And if they think that you're not the best place to publish it, they won't send it to you. And so we've earned a good reputation among literary journals. The over the course of these last 10 years, we've published 280 authors. And this is new work from the authors. Some of them are new writers, and some of them are established writers. They come from 35 states, 10 foreign countries, and as well as the Delmarva Peninsula and the Chesapeake region. As I say, we are open to submissions from all writers. We don't, not just local writers. And this enables the local writer, if they're accepted, to put a feather in their cap, if you will. This is a real honor to be selected. And where is it? Where can you get it? You can get it from Amazon.com, the largest bookseller in the world. And you can also get it in Easton and in Oxford. And you can get it directly from our website. where all submissions are go. I also would mention that...
What is the website?
The website is delmarvareview.com. And that's where, if I want to submit a piece of poetry or fiction or nonfiction, that's where I do it. It's all electronic. And then people like you will start reading the fiction, and Anne will start reading the poetry.
Have you thought yet of publishing maybe a poem or a short piece of literature or something on the website in order to whet our appetite for what might be in the issue?
We have discussed that as a editorial board, and that's something that I hope we'll be able to start doing this year if we can. It would be really a great idea. We already submit published pieces to Spy Publications Online, for example, in Chestertown and in Talbot County, and those are published every month. So there's no reason why we shouldn't do it on our website as well. You asked about the 10th anniversary issue, and it's what anyone would expect from an anniversary issue. It's bigger. It's bigger than any other issue that we've published. It's 233 pages. That's big for a literary journal. In addition to being large, we also are publishing the winner of the Chesapeake Voices contest, who happens, it's a piece that takes place in the Delmarva, but it's actually by a South Carolina writer. This particular issue, in addition to being larger, we're publishing the work of 40 authors. That's 41 poems. It's 11 short stories, five book reviews, and five nonfiction pieces. The cover is by Cal Jackson, who's a photographer in Easton, Maryland. And through a competition that we have, we're looking for local writers and photographers, local artists and photographers, to send us work for the cover.
Well, it's a beautiful cover, Wilson, that turned over basket of oyster shells. And I want our listeners to know that there's a picture of the cover on the Delmarva Public Radio website. So if they want to have a look at a beautiful piece of photography, they can go there and see the cover of the Delmarva Review.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Wonderful.
So tell me something about the Delmarva Review. I understand, as its publisher, you said initially that it was published by the Eastern Shore Writers Association. Who publishes it now? What's going on with the Delmarva Review now?
We're published by the Delmarva Review Literary Fund, which is a nonprofit 501c3 tax-deductible fund, which means that private and public contributions can be received by the Delmarva Review for publication. Without that 501c3 status, we couldn't get public grants or even private grants, for that matter. So that's the that's what the fund is. What does it do? It promotes literature and the literary arts across the Delmarva Peninsula.
You mentioned, and of course, because of my involvement, I know that we publish poetry, we publish nonfiction, we publish fiction, and we publish the reviews. Tell me something about the nonfiction that the review publishes. What kind of essays? What kind of work are you looking for?
We're looking for work that is that really touches feelings and that connects people. And I think that if you add one other word, which we hope is true in our poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, it's for the work to be memorable. And if we can achieve that, then we've achieved what we consider is literary work, which is exciting to us. I think to help you a little bit, help answer the question that you raised on the nonfiction side, I'm going to mention one piece in particular here. There are five pieces that are in the current review that are all good, and they're very, very different. They go from essay material to memoir, and all under the auspices of nonfiction. This particular piece is called Hospital Visit Number 19 by Christina Morgan, and it is being nominated for a Pushcart Prize this year. And it's very interesting. Christina Morgan is a young woman from Phoenix, Arizona, who suffers from two maladies. One is addiction, and the other is mental illness, the mental illness being schizophrenia. And regardless of those, which are lifetime struggles, she got her MFA from Arizona State University and is an accomplished writer. Talking about what is a literary nonfiction piece, I'm going to read you a couple of pieces from this essay, which I think describe what we are looking for in terms of what is literary. In the opening, in the very opening line, Christina writes, "The doctor will try to shake loose my shadow and fail. My schizophrenia is in full bloom. I am told the elephants have moved." It's interesting because the elephants are two things. One, the elephants are the voices that she hears all the time. And the second is it's a locket from her mother. The hospital is the same as I remember, a series of doors, the same color, marching down a long hall. That's a beautiful way of describing, and that's why I regard it as literary. The voices I hear are louder in there as I walk past the room with the television sets in the hospital. I respond to the voices in a friendly way so they will not be irritated and call me names. "I miss you." All of a sudden, the voice changes. She's now talking about her writing teacher. And her writing actually is one of the things that has helped propel her and to being free of addiction and free of schizophrenia. And she talks about her writing professor. She says, "You touch lives." In the very end of this piece, and she's in the hospital because she tried to commit suicide. For the 19th time, she is in the hospital. In the very end, she says, "After eating, I return the tray to the cart. John, the psych nurse, approaches me. 'Good morning, Christina.' 'Morning. Are you feeling suicidal today?' Only in a psych hospital should a person start the conversation with a question. 'No,' I responded. And the voices, still there, but not bad. 'How was breakfast?' 'Good. I'm going to come home soon, I think. Are you ready?' 'Yes.'" And she's released by her doctor. At the very end, she greets her family. And she says, "Those voices outside myself are well, and are present. I am glad to hold hands with my loved ones again. We wish on the stars together and delight in the moon. My wish is simple: stay home and love."
Well, it certainly illustrates the power of writing. I interviewed Dr. Mary Brinkmeyer once. Mary Brinkmeyer is a psychologist who works for the U.S. Navy in Norfolk, Virginia, dealing with military personnel suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I asked Mary how she used writing, how they use writing in the therapy that they have. And she expressed a quite interesting thing. One was they just have them write their experiences and that they want to write, and they write. And then they work with them, and that's mainly giving them tools to deal with their stress disorder. And then she has them write the same experience again and looks at how they have changed their relationship to that experience. So a little bit of that in this essay that you read from and told us about. Well, Ann Colwell is the poetry editor of the Review, and Ann, you've been on the program a couple of times.
I've been very, very lucky to be here.
So our audience is a little familiar with you, but give us a little bit of your background again, and as you describe that background. If I want to submit a poem to the Delmarva Review, what are you going to look for that makes you say, oh, this one, yes, set this one aside?
Yeah. Well, I'm a poet and fiction writer myself, and I've published a couple of books of poems. I have a doctorate in English literature, but my specialty was in contemporary American poetry and especially Elizabeth Bishop. And so I have read and loved poetry my whole entire life. It is my thing. I love fiction too, write fiction, but poetry was my first love. And so one of the things that even though there are a lot of poems to read, it's a wonderful thing to be able to edit the review because you see how many people are out there trying to make sense of the world in poems. And so when people tell me that poetry is dead and poetry is a dead art, I would invite them to come and see how many people read and write poetry by seeing how many submissions, how many poetry submissions we get. And so what that says, too, is that because we get a lot of submissions as a reader, and my fellow reader, terrific poet herself, Wendy Ingersoll Perry, the two of us, when we read, I think we look for the first thing we look for is a strong voice. And it's something like what Wilson was saying about connecting. I mean, you want a strong voice on the page so that as soon as you begin to read the poem, you think about the person, the voice of the person who's talking to you. So it should feel alive and immediate. And things that kill a poem are opening with cliches or lazy writing, right? Those kinds of things kill a poem. But if you have vivid images, surprising language, and somebody who's speaking to you on the page, I think that's what you're really looking for, is a poet with a voice. Who's able to use the language in ways to make you wake up and feel alive and feel connected to their world and to what they're saying.
You and I have talked about your poetry on occasion, and I want the listeners to know that that the poetry that you write is excellent. It's actually fantastic.
Thank you so much, Al.
I can't exactly remember the name of it, but it's something like Mary's Side.
Mary tells her side.
Mary tells her. What a fantastic! I read it wrong, but I thought it was the Immaculate Conception.
But it works both ways. It's not wrong. It's just intentionally ambiguous.
And I'm not giving up. I'm going to stake my opinion on the Immaculate Conception in that poem.
That's right.
You can't talk about the feathers of the angel without getting to that. Well, Would you read some poems?
Sure,
for us,
I would be happy to read
today.
Some poems. Do you want to start with Jennifer Hyland's poem?
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Tell us something about these are six poems, as I recall.
Yes, it's a six.
Tell us something about these poems, and then we'll read them.
One of the things that's interesting about these poems is, first of all, that it is a six poem series, and so when we read them, we thought they were all terrific, and we actually, you know, we went back and forth a little bit about, can you just take four and five, or four, one, two, three, because we usually don't take a six-poem series, but they were so good that we said, no, we're taking them all.
Let me interrupt you, because you had said earlier that you wanted to read one.
I did.
And I read them.
Yes, and then
I said there's no way that we can read one of these. We've got to read all six.
Right,
of them.
And one of the reasons you have to read all six and you have to publish all six is because they are, as you said when we were talking about it, a progression. That they each poem begins. The title of each poem is the body, and then the next line is of the buck, and so it's about a deer. Or it's at least ostensibly about a deer, but it's also about bodies and about the nature of the body and what it means to be in a body and to escape from a body, to die. It's just a beautiful progression as it moves through this. It's almost a meditation on the nature of being inside a body and inside the flesh.
Well, I appreciate your indulging me to let me read among these poems with you. So, why don't you go ahead and begin?
Okay, this is number one, the body of the buck, slung by the heels from a beam, hangs frozen in free fall at the barn entrance, limbs outstretched as if caught mid dive. A moment before crashing against ground, yet perhaps piercing instead that dung-packed spread of dirt, entering earth as easily as its own element, leaving only the smallest hayseed ripple behind. And what of it, then, vanished beneath the surface? Does it stroke like a sturgeon below the bedrock, churning through magma and molten iron, crossing past the core and on, until it is washed again by pebbles, silt, and plunges at last into the twilight of some lost Eden of poplar and blackberry glades? Or does it rather loosen the laces that bind cell to cell, hoof and muscle dissolving in humus, sand, clay, the space within the nostrils merging with the space between each flake of dirt, its substance dispersing, growing larger than the barnyard, underspreading the fields, infiltrating the forest beneath the forest, flooding outward until every hill, every river is contained in the wide sea of its dissolution.
The body of the buck splays amid air like a brazen star. It has given up all caution. How casually it reveals everything. The tender hollows at the root of each limb, the throat elongate and soft with vessels, the white belly fur unfolded from anus to chin. All that was once kept hidden is now spread like a banner, guts ribboning the forest floor, tail flung back, slashed belly, chest opened and scooped for the wind to explore. The body is fearless now. It kicks against the sky, opens wide to the gathering dark.
3. The body of the buck blazes like any ordinary thing. Late light strikes the pale underside, two halves curving around a small abyss, cupped hands through which a treasure slid unseen.
The body of the buck slowly emerges, slick as a fetus from flesh and fur, inch by inch. The heavy robe of skin rolls back to reveal a figure slim and long as a half-grown girl, claret-colored, tender as starlight, trembling with moisture like an usher tear. Strange angel, strung by a chain, it hangs midway from heaven to earth and refuses to choose between them.
The body of the buck is gone. Shape and shadow, the space it had claimed, filled in at once by hay-dusty air, the soft breath of cows, tang of wood smoke and manure. The body of the buck is gone, and the barn holds no memory. Now evening hangs from the chain above the threshold. Soon it too will vanish, and the night's soft body will dangle alone. The body of the buck plows the darkness, the gunnels of its parted flanks and ribcage smacked by a foam of stars. Spiny keel, tail rudder, mast planted, where the heart once grew. This craft, this carcass, this coracle, an alien in alien seas, plies the spacious winds with invisible sail. Its dead eyes scan the deep as it noses farther and farther out. No one can call it back now. It is sailing beyond the galaxy. It has cast off any allegiance to this earth.
What's going on in this poem,
Anne?
Oh,
it's a beautiful poem.
It is.
It's a series of beautiful poems.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I think, as I said before, it's a meditation, and I think it's a meditation on the nature of living in a body, but also on the nature of leaving a body, and what does it mean to leave the body. And it seems to me that through the different movements of the poem, it's a little orchestral, isn't it? That themes come and then they leave and come back and leave and come back, and in each one of them, she's thinking about what happens not just to the body itself. And there's some beautiful images of the dead body of the buck, but also that great image in the first poem of it plunging under the earth and coming up on the other side into someplace else. And then at the end of the poem, the meditation on it being free from body. But there's something in Yeats's poem where he talks about, you know, once out of nature, I will never take my bodily form from any earthly thing. But such a form is, I'm going to misquote. But such a form as Grecian. Artisans make, I'm misquoting it now, but he says, I'll never take my form from any natural thing, but then the only thing he can think of is a natural thing, because we can't imagine anything else. And I think what happens at the end of this poem is that the buck is free. It can't do anything earthly anymore. It's cast off any allegiance to the earth, but the image that she has to give us for it is an earthly image. It's the image of the buck like being ship-like. And it's still in a body in a way. The ribs become the sides of the ship. And so the only way that we imagine death is an earthly way, because we haven't cast off any allegiance to the earth, and neither has the poem. So we're still, you know, we're still caught in, you know, what is born and what is begotten. We can't escape it. And it's a it's a beautiful poem to me about the nature of our own bodiliness. But she does it. She puts it off, of course, on the buck, because we can look at the buck so much more with so much more precision than we could if that was a human body.
She gives us a hint. She gives us a hint in the opening poem at the end when she talks about in the wide sea of its dissolution.
Right, that's right.
And then the rest of the poem.
Right.
Is
and we end up at the sea again in six.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a beautiful
poem. There's one more poem I would like for you to read, if you don't mind. And it's Gibbon's Ruark, Lightness in Age. Yes. Quite a different poem. But would you read that one for us?
It's interesting, though, to put together with those poems, because it's also a poem about escaping the body, about the lightness of the moving through, although this is a very human poem about escaping the body. Lightness in Age. Lightness in Age. It means not having to muscle your bag onto the baggage rack for the flight to Dublin. A girl your daughter's age will do that for you. It means the boy distributes the groceries justly in your carryalls so you'll make the car without spillage. Those lightnesses are not to be taken lightly. But more than those, it's the many-faceted lightness of the goldfinch feathering down at morning, the chickadee's darting blur for the one seed he spirits away and devours discreetly. And it's the tenderness of a long-known kiss touching your mouth or eyelid or anywhere with this new lightness. It's flickering backlit by the glow of that consuming first one 50 years ago.
I saw the progression in this poem, in the sense of the practical lightness at the beginning, when the child your daughter's age picks up your luggage for you.
Yeah.
That kind of practical approach. And then the lightness of I don't know, maybe it's the aesthetic in the sense of the goldfinch and the chickadee. And so we progress from a very practical to a very aesthetic, but also still very real.
Yes.
And then, for me anyway, reading it, the last four lines, the lightness of memory.
Yes.
And how that kind of abstract lightness can touch you physically.
Yeah.
And that's at least what I saw.
I think so, too. And I think it's another poem that's very much about the body and about, you know, about the way that the body works and moves and the way that the body ages. But also, it seems to me to be celebratory of, you know, that the fact that it's backlit by the glow of that consuming first kiss 50 years ago. That there's something so beautiful about that lightness that still picks up the light from years and years ago.
Beautiful poems, all of them. And I think that you're to be congratulated on the selection of the poetry. The poetry in the Delmarva Review is always incredibly strong. And
I think part of that is what Wilson said about we get submissions. I mean, we turn down poetry that's terrific. But, it's just we get so many submissions from so many great poets from across the country and across the world. And we're just very we're very lucky and blessed, but we're also, like, to thank Wilson and everybody who's worked on the review for all this time, because it's something. It's really It's really accomplished. A lot of accomplished work.
I have the privilege of getting to read the fiction submissions, and it is a privilege. And I have to say that the fiction that we have in this particular issue is incredibly strong. It is as strong, in a sense, as the poetry.
Oh, yeah.
And as strong as that essay that Wiltson read. The fiction in this issue is just incredible. And there's just one that I want to mention, and you read a portion of that one, Lindsay Then. And Lindsay Then, for me, the reason I liked Lindsay Then is because, first of all, it brought a unique voice. And you expressed a bit of that voice. Now, some people might call it experimental writing because the piece you read at the beginning of the program was one sentence. And I've never seen so many commas strung together. But it's kind of a breathless piece. And the whole piece is kind of a breathless piece of this young woman just talking about what they're doing and where they're going, and they're riding through a subdivision. My God, who would care? But she just talks about the subdivision, and in looking at the houses, she talks to her companion about what they are doing in those houses, the mundane things they are doing in those houses. But more importantly, imagine what we would do in those houses. And with her friend, you know, she's talking to her friend in the piece that you read. I know it's my turn tonight, and I'll have dinner ready. Momo, and she's just kind of bouncing along. The whole piece is that way. But so I found a lyrical quality about it. I don't know, Anne, if you see that or not, but I found just a lyrical quality in the piece.
It's very rhythmic when you read it.
And the voice, this person, this is the voice of what, Wilson, a millennial or whatever. But it's a unique kind of talking that we hear quite often. And I also think that it's a fascinating, in this story, I'm trying to get listeners out here to read this thing, right? the other thing is an amazing innate use of imagination, because and time, imagination and time, because she's talking about their relationship and what they're gonna do. And these millennial kids and how the things they're going to do. And it never works out that way. There's this poignant end. And you think, well, a poignant end, okay, that's all right. But then she embraces the poignant nature of the finish. And I thought, well, I thought this is pretty good, and I was enamored. I was enamored with it. Well, Wilson and Anne, thank you very much for joining me today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I appreciate having you very much.
Thank you, Hal.
And I have to say, how much I appreciate working with both of you on the Delmarva Review as well. Let's turn to our drama now, The Church. We begin with a short interview with the author, Philip Barbara, whom we're happy to have with us today. Philip, thanks for joining us on Delmarva Today Writers Edition.
Happy to be here, Hal.
Philip, your story is titled The Church, but the whole story takes place in a deli in Manhattan. It's lunchtime in this deli, and in the little drama that we have adapted from your short story, we're going to spend basically the lunchtime with the manager talking to us. But what interested me was the title, The Church, the sense that this all takes place in a deli and not a church. How do you reconcile these two settings?
I came up with the title when I was nearing the end of the writing and rewriting. In this kosher cafeteria, my characters are finding physical nourishment from eating a good lunch. But they're also finding a certain spiritual comfort. Outside, it's the busiest city in America, New York. Inside, it's a safe, secure, welcoming place. They've had a busy day, but here, they're gathering themselves like people do when they go to a house of prayer, whether it be a church or a synagogue. Many people whisper to themselves when they pray. For me, a key symbol in the story is when the Israeli and Palestinian are sitting across from one another about to eat the same kind of soup. Steam rising from the soup is like a whisper. That whisper and the thankfulness to have food to eat, it could give the reader the impression that these guys are at a house of prayer.
Well, Philip, I know that you're living in the D.C. area now. Give us a little bit of your background. How is it that you know so much about a New York deli?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. I mean, I grew up in northern New Jersey, but I went to college in the Bronx, graduate school in Brooklyn. I drove a cab in Manhattan for a year, putting myself through sophomore year at school. But I started out in journalism as a copy boy at the New York Daily News. And in that role, you get sent around throughout the city. You're in glamorous places and at high-end functions. And then the next moment, you're at a deli counter trying to grab a bite to eat. And especially as a cab driver, I picked up every imaginable kind of person. So I am a New Yorker, and I'm, as a journalist, I've always been a street-walking reporter. Go anywhere, and that's how I've gotten to know New York as well as I have.
Bill, what's the genesis of this story then? I clearly, you must have spent a bit of time in New York delis. How did you come up with this story?
I'm glad I get a chance to tell about this moment, this actual moment that happened. In the early 1980s, I was an editor at Aviation Week and Space Technology. That's a McGraw-Hill magazine on Avenue of the Americas in Manhattan. One of my favorite places for lunch was a kosher cafeteria, and right in the heart of the Diamond District. It was just like the cafeteria in the story. Customers took trays and moved up the line. The sandwich makers waited on you from behind glass partitions that always seemed to be steamed up. You've seen this kind of place. And like in the story, there were tables and celebrity pictures on the walls. One day I'm standing there eating my sandwich, listening to the music over the PA system, and Barbara Streisand's song People starts. In a few moments, the room, it seemed, totally quieted down, as if everyone was listening too, maybe reflecting on the meaning of the song or just enjoying it and while eating their lunch. Outside, it's clamorous, but inside, it seemed to me there wasn't a sound, and this lasted for maybe 40, 50 seconds, perhaps a minute. It was a dramatic moment that made a lasting impression. in 2008 or so, when I decided to try to find time from full-time journalism to write fiction, I had a few story ideas, a few rough drafts, and I decided to make the most of this memory. How do you dramatize a setting? That's all I had, the scene at this cafeteria, this moment of silence. And thinking about it, the Diamond District is an Orthodox Jewish community. My story needed conflict, and I thought of using the never-ending Palestinian-Israeli conflict that had come up in Reuters stories and that I was editing, at least on a weekly basis. And this was also after 9/11. As a New Yorker, I had gone up to New York right after, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I really wanted to see what the city was like. And I would talk to anyone standing in line, anywhere I could ask questions, basically nosy reporter stuff, although I wasn't writing a story. I was just doing this for my own curiosity. Everybody wanted to talk, and everybody spoke in a caring tone of voice, and I decided to use that with this story as well. Within a year or so, whether it be in New York or in Jersey, where I have a lot of family, or in Washington, I began seeing people wearing the New York Fire Department caps and sometimes T-shirts as well. And to me, that was a way that people were showing solidarity with those 300 firemen.
Well, that certainly shows up as a crucial element in your story, also, Philip. Philip, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning, and we're going to turn now to your wonderful short story, "The Church," that was published in the Delmarva Review and adapted for radio. Thank you very much again, Philip.
Thank you, Hal.
And now for our drama, "The Church," by Philip Barbara.
The boss tells me to shorten the line. Yesterday, it was out the door down the sidewalk, almost to the 47th Street Diamond District. So many people itching to get in, eat lunch, get back to their office. Keeping them out of the doorway is one of his big worries.
I don't want a scuffle to break out. I don't want this place in the New York Post, Felix.
Leo behind the counter with me thinks the boss just wants us to move the hot dogs faster, make the sandwiches faster. We look at one another and shake our heads. No lines? We know it's not going to happen. It's his father's name in lights over the door. Putnik's famous kosher cafeteria. I've seen him fire people. Like Manuel. One morning there was a flap over a big catering order. How many sandwiches were corned beef? How many pastrami? The order went out, and then it got busy as usual for lunch. When things thinned out afterward, I thought everything was forgotten. But the boss wasn't through yet.
Manuel, take off your apron. You're through here.
He had a small brown packet with Manuel's pay already. Manuel was right about that order, but the boss is like that. I'm waiting for the right moment to point out he doesn't run a mess hall at an army barracks. We got autographed photos of Howard Cosell, Gene Wilder, Ed Koch with Bess Meyerson, Billy Crystal, Paul Simon and Walt Frazier on the walls. When the boss isn't busy, he stands below George C. Scott as General Patton. Might not be seen with Sophia Loren as the Madonna, but I try to keep peace. He did accept one of my suggestions, that we offer the police a 10% discount so someone in blue is always here. I keep a table for them so they have a clear view of the door. Everyone worries about terrorism again. Smaller, like Orlando or San Bernardino. Not another 9/11. The boss has ideas of his own.
Maybe we can do more phone takeout platters, Felix. That eases the situation.
I'll look at him like he's a total rookie. We tried that before. You gave takeout platters special names like Yankees home plate. Totally flopped. He nods, recollection kicking in.
All right. Why didn't that idea fly?
Look, the food tastes better eaten in. People like the atmosphere. A look out over the room. Bright lights streaming in through the windows. The smells of steamed meat and grilled peppers and onions. The boss looks too, nods again. He knows he has a nice place. When you cross the threshold here, the atmosphere changes you. When I started 18 years ago, I thought it was just the heat in winter and AC in summer. But that's not it. It's more than that. As lunchtime nears, I'm pondering the problem, keeping the line short. I'm distracted, though. I go about turning the franks and the knishes and steaming the rolls so they're just right for my regulars. The counter window steams up and plates begin to clatter. About 11:45, right on time, people start sliding trays down the line, and I'm forking it over, slicing the corned beef and pastrami, piling it high the way they're used to. I'm looking out for Florence from the UN, who told me she'll be here with some special guests, and I'm wondering who. At about 12:10, my favorite couple comes in. As usual, they're mooning at each other. They take their sandwich and dogs on a shared tray, pay, walk to the center of our universe, the ketchup and mustard stand. They give the plastic bottles a squeeze, a dab of mustard, and a dab of ketchup. They take seats across from one another at a small table, not wanting to miss the other's slightest wink. The music is playing, and as I'm looking across the room, I can clearly hear one of my favorite tunes above the din, that Barbara Streisand song about people who need people, how they're the luckiest in the world. I feel everyone's contentment, too. A feeling deep in your soul says you were half, now you're whole. No more hunger and thirst, but first be a person who needs people. People who need people are the luckiest people in the world. I watch some people walk in alone, but then share a table, smiling to one another by introduction, and then sitting quietly, ruminating with their food and their thoughts. That, to me, is a sense of things right in the world. A customer jolts me back from my dream when he orders.
A Novolox omelet with onions, salted butter, with rye toast.
Sorry, sir, we don't serve salted butter.
No salted butter? You have salted everything else. Can you send out for some?
He sounds like the butter might be a deal-breaker. So I try to satisfy him. Can't do that, it's your regular. But I'll tell you what, come back tomorrow and I'll have some for you. I spoon some butter into a pan, place it on the grill, shake some salt over it. After it melts, I'll put it in the fridge with my name on it. My name's Felix, ask for me. The guy nods. I see a pity smile as he slides his tray to the cashier. Then a guy I've never seen before comes down the line and looks hard at the menu on the wall and asks for something I never heard of.
I'll take a national knockwurst.
Plain as that. Wasn't sure I heard right, but he says it again. I'll take a national knockwurst. Like it's a brand name or something. I know all the brands of kielbasa and every kind of beef we've served. I never heard of national knockwurst. Sir, you must mean Hebrew national. Kosher all beef franks. It's our most popular lunch. Splendid with mustard and sauerkraut. Some people take one, some take two. I roll a half dozen over on the grill with my tongs by way of showing him. He arches his neck over the steam window to see better. What do you have?
No, that's not it. All I'm asking for is what I came for. A national knockwurst, made with U.S. beef. I mean, is this a New York kosher restaurant or what?
He steps away from the steam window and looks around undecided. I got a laugh. A national knockwurst, as if with capital letters. Well, if he's trying to be a New Yorker, I figured he'd appreciate a deal. Why not try today's special? Two Hebrew national franks and an orange drink, $4. Because you look like you're new to town and we appreciate you giving us your business, I think I can arrange for you a free knish. He's still resisting, so I try again. How about a fast-sliced pastrami on rye? Or a Novolox omelet with onions? It's a recipe as old as the wallpaper.
Okay, give me just a hot dog special.
I fit two dogs into buns, place them with a knish on a plate, and hand it over. He moves down the line to Lois at the cash register, grabs an orange drink, and stops short to look up at the picture of Cameron Diaz. I served her once. I think I did. You can't tell, so many beautiful ladies. By 12:30, the line's all the way out the door. And I remember what the boss says. Keep the line short. What are you going to do? We're busy. It's a sunny spring day. Customers ask how I took up kitchen work. When I was a kid in Williamsburg, I stole food from sidewalk stalls. My mom encouraged it because otherwise we might not eat. But I kept getting caught, and they finally sent me to the Hardwick School for Tough Kids up in Ulster in 75 when I was 15. The food there was terrible. Every night was mystery meat with beans or corn. We threw out more than we ate. After a while, I got assigned to the kitchen and cooked for myself on the side, simmering onions with the meat. Word got around. Others wanted what I ate. It helped me get along with everybody. One night, two older kids with a zip gun grabbed the guard. That would be their ticket out, like Cagney in the movie. See? But the warden wouldn't do it. They held the guard for 2 days until the one without the gun gave up, tired and hungry. The other kid tells the warden to send in some food and coffee, for the guard, too. I'm told to make up some sandwiches, but no coffee. Eventually, the kid lets the guard out, but he's still got the gun. He calls out he wants another sandwich, but with no mustard. No mustard? He has a preference like he's at a deli counter? So I make the sandwich the way he wants. In a little while, he surrenders. The warden nodded his thanks to all involved. Just before one at the restaurant, two of our finest officers, Tonelli and Donnelly, come in. Tonelli likes pastrami on rye. Donnelly orders the two-dog special. They're soft-spoken when they're here. On the streets, it's the harsh noises. Here they find peace. I like to say in here we have music, munching, and meditating. Finally, I see Florence move toward me. She's hard to miss. Black, real tall, long neck. Voice airy like she's talking and eating hot sweet potatoes. She comes in a lot since we're so close to the east side. Brings someone from some distant country who arrived for a new UN assignment. Every variety of individual. While here, she offers them the NYFD cap that everybody wants since 9/11. She always carries a few. I prepare her usual. 2 francs, peppers and onions to go with a tall beer. She introduces me to these two fellas she's with. Both with long beards, black suits, white shirts. You'd think they're brothers. She tells them the food here is safe for both. One's Israeli, the other's Palestinian, she tells me. This is Mo, she says. Mo bows to me. I return the bow. Moses, is it? No. Mohammed, he says. Welcome to New York, Mohammed. She motions to the other guy and introduces him, also a Mo. Welcome, Moses, I say to him. The guy nods. Both men go for chicken noodle soup and bread. The three of them make their way to a nearby table. The two guys sitting across from each other, with Florence in the middle. I see them clearly. They close their eyes in a silent prayer before taking up their spoons. The steam from the soup rises like a whisper. They talk and gesture. Florence is in there too, sitting erect. For a moment, it must be serious talk making me think. Hey, the Mideast peace talks right here at Putnik's. But eventually they become preoccupied and silent. They just look around, eating, not talking, devoted to their lunch, nodding approval to one another. Then that Streisand song fades in again. Sometimes I add my own words. People who need mustard, people who need ketchup, are the luckiest people in the world, with one side dish, one very special side dish, now resting deep in your soul, says you are half, now you whole. No more hunger and thirst. You think I've been working here too long, but I haven't. Hey, music's supposed to be transporting, isn't it? Then Elliot slides his tray down and orders the two-dog special, a knish and a pastrami sandwich. I think he's compensating for not eating here when he was overseas doing business.
Hey, Felix, what's the mellowing agent in your recipes? And by the way, take care of that cold of yours. You sound a little rusty.
None. No mellowing agent. We serve lunch fast and hot. That's it.
You know, I'd like to subsidize a Thanksgiving Day turkey float for Putniks.
Would it be a deli sandwich or a hot dog on wheels?
Yeah, why not a big balloon like a souffle of a chef's hat? With eyes and ears smiling down, would fit right in the scene. Images of Thanksgiving Day are among our country's most important exports. Don't you know that?
Let me think about it, Elliot.
Suddenly there's a racket right outside, just what the boss hates. Some guy goes after Gloria, the meter maid. You can't park this side after 1 o'clock. She's writing a ticket when he returns to his car and goes berserk, calling her every foul name under the sun. Our door's open, so everyone hears this, breaking the spell of our place. The guy shoves her against the plate glass window. She goes down, and the room collectively gasps. Two customers in the line outside get her up. She runs in and takes cover behind me, right behind the counter. Donnelly and Tonelli go out to intervene. The guy gets nasty with them, too. So before you know it, he's against his car in handcuffs and off to go. Hustle Leo out there with the rest of the officer's lunch all wrapped. A parking ticket. Handcuffs. Jesus.
Okay, that's it. Felix, shut the door.
But there's people in line there.
They'll have to be patient outside.
I see a few regulars looking right at me through the window. I feel helpless. But as soon as the boss is distracted, I open it again. He has to be sensible. You can't close the door on people. Then the National Knockwurst guy comes back to the counter.
By the way, do you have a menu printed in Braille?
Sorry, we don't.
Because I'd like to bring someone here for lunch. Because she's blind.
I'm getting the picture. When the boss butts in, what's the hold up here and who opened the door? I was just getting an idea from a new customer. He wants to know if we'd print up a menu in Braille.
Braille? For why?
For a blind person.
That'd really slow things down.
He's right, I know. But I'm a smart guy, too. So I tell him, just think, boss. Some Hollywood sitcom writer might work the idea into an episode, like in that show with the crazy soup guy. Instead, you be the nice guy. Word'd get around Putnik's welcomes to handicap. Would be good for business.
Lots of blind people good for business. Who'd have known that? Okay.
That's when out of the corner of my eye I see Florence and her two Moes walking out. Only one's wearing the NYFD cap. But I have a feeling she'll be back with the other one. He liked the food. They'll eat, talk some more, and he'll eventually lose his objections. He'll wear the cap.
A great thank you to our cast. Tom Welch as Felix, Delmarva Public Radio's Chris Rank as the boss and as customer one, Don Rush as customer two, and your host as Elliot. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.